I'll give you a brief introduction for those of you who are here for the first time for his talk. Ajahn Brahm resides in Perth, Australia. He's the abbot there. So he runs what he fondly calls it a monk factory. He's got about 22 monks from various countries, and two of them you had seen on television. One was from Norway, and the other one was American Vietnamese. He was born in England, where he grew up, and then went to Cambridge University and graduated with a degree in theoretical physics. After which, with his interest in Buddhism, he decided to sell off everything he had to go try out monastic life in Bangkok. So that's where he got ordained and later learned about Ajahn Chah, the great meditation teacher in the forest, and became his disciple and lived in Thailand for about 7 years before he was invited with another monk to set up the monastery in Serpentine, Australia. So he's our spiritual patron and ever so popular whenever he comes to Singapore. And I think some of you may have known about it through our newsletter, our emails. But how many of you found out about it through the newspaper? Then we know whether we should ever advertise again. Because if Straits Time is not well read, then we won't advertise. Okay. Anyway, those of you who are not members, we certainly invite you to join so that you will be kept up to date with all our new activities and upcoming program. And you can just pick up a form downstairs and sign up. It's only $30 a year. Okay, with that, if I may kindly invite all of you to put your hands together. And if it's not too inconvenient, just stand up and put your hands together, and then we'd just like to show our respect in inviting Ajahn Brahm to the front. And, you know, actually, you can clap because it makes me feel like a star. So cool. Thank you. That's pretty good. Okay, please have a seat. Oh, you have screens next time. You know, in Colombo, after a Dhamma talk he gave, and I started to clap, and I realized I was the only one clapping. Because in Sri Lanka, nobody claps after a Dhamma talk. And then he looks at all the Sri Lankans and says, "She's from Singapore." Okay, now I'm sure there's a lot of politics in your life, if you're here tonight. Supposedly both in your office and home, right? Which is not unusual for any one of us. But why would we be asking a monk about, you know, politics and problems in relationship? They're supposed to have gone all the way from all this and probably never worked in an office. But I think Ajahn Brahm is no ordinary monk. He can talk about anything. First of all. But actually running a monastery is like running an office of some sort. So perhaps we can invite you to say a few words to start off about what is actually politics in the way we use it so freely. Oh, there's politics in the office. Oh, there's politics at home. What would you say it is all about, this politics thing, and that causes relationship problems?
Yeah, okay, yeah. I think a lot of times the politics is just where we focus in any relationship, whether it's in an office or whether it's in a family or an organization or even a monastery, is when we focus on the wrong areas. We focus on what I need or what they need. And instead of in any institution, in any organization or family, what's most important is not what I want. What's most important is not what they want. What's most important is what we want. And so a lot of times I think the politics come when we either focus on the other or we focus on ourselves instead of focusing on the middle. And that's that middle way of Buddhism is by far the most effective. So instead of having arguments, we say, well, you know, what do we need in our relationship? What do we need in our office? What are we trying to achieve? What's our goals? Not what's my goal, not what's your goal, what's our goals? And when we actually look at a community, and then I think we can realize that how cooperation is very important. I mentioned this to our education ministers in Australia because now I do get involved in some respects with politics, or rather with politicians, because politicians are serving our communities, they're serving our nations, and it's wonderful if we can avail them about Buddhist principles. But some of those Buddhist principles is like learning just how to cooperate with each other. And one of the things with the education department, which I suggested, and I keep on pushing this idea around, at the moment all our schools encourage competition. And so we compete against each other in the classroom to get the best marks or to get average marks and to get the places in universities and maybe in jobs afterwards. But anybody should know that in real life, your own personal achievement is important, but we also have to somehow encourage, and the best way of encouraging it is by rewards, cooperation. And so in order to do that, I suggested a long time ago something like the following, that in our schools and universities, when we have the end of the term marks, which we have to somehow grade our students, maybe 60-70% of our score should be our personal score, what we've achieved by ourselves. And the other 20-30%, 40% should be averaged over our whole class, our whole group, by which we would always be rewarding our ability to cooperate and work together. So if there was, say, in a class, some poorly behaving students, those who weren't scoring well in, say, maths or science, it will be in the interests of those who are the top of the class to help, to assist, to work with the weaker ones. Because it would be their interest, they would be marked on their ability to cooperate and raise the whole level of the team. At the moment, the only teamwork which we encourage in our societies is on the sports field. But why can't we do that in our academic life as well? Because as you know, when you move in to an office, sometimes if it's competitive, in other words, I'm thinking of my own career and my own advancement, that goes against the best interest of the company at large. It goes against the best interest of the country. It goes against the best interest of our world. Competition is great, but we also need to reward somehow cooperation. And I think that's one of the reasons why what we call is politics in an office or in a family or in even a country is our inability to cooperate and always to be competing. I may get into trouble for this, but sometimes I admire the Singaporean system simply because in the Western system it doesn't matter what the opposition says, you always disagree with it, even if it's a good idea. Because you're always competing with the other side for the next election. And I think that is not very good for the well-being and for servicing a country. We have to learn how to cooperate, not just to compete. We have to have a balance between competing and cooperation. And I really do feel that it's because of our education system and also because of the ethos of our societies is always on competition. And we really think that that's the only way forward. It's not the only way forward. You have to have cooperation as well. That's the strength of an office. But it's also the strength of a family as well. Because once you are living together in a small apartment or a small house, if you don't learn to cooperate, you're going to have a big argument, some big problem. Every time you have an argument, you're not doing anything for the furtherance of your own happiness or the happiness of and welfare of your family. You're basically wasting time. So we have to learn how to cooperate. And I'm going to mention something now which is very close to my mind, because yesterday I came from Sydney, and the reason I came through the evening flight from Sydney to Perth and the overnight flight to Singapore, where I arrived earlier this morning, the reason why I spent 2 days of very precious time in Sydney, because we had a meeting there of all the members of the different Buddhist traditions, the ordained members, what we call Sangha, both monks and nuns, not just from my tradition, Theravada, but the Chinese nuns, the Taiwanese nuns, the Korean monks, the monks in the Pho Quang Shan group, the Vajrayana monks, the Vietnamese monks, and all the nuns, everybody was invited to have what we call the Australia Sangha Association. I wanted to call it the National Australia Sangha Association, just so we could have the very wonderful acronym NASA. I thought that sounded better than NASA, but nevertheless I was voted down. But the point was, we're forming an association. We are cooperating. Of course, our temples also compete, and I think that's healthy. It's great to have the Theravada temple right next door to the Mahayana temple, right next door to the Tibetan temple, because when we compete for market share, we have to up our game. We have to increase the way we present our goods. So competition, even between the three main traditions, is great. But we also have cooperation as well. And the cooperation means that in many areas we compete, which is healthy. But in so many other areas, it's something which is common to Buddhism. Let's put aside Buddhism, common to spirituality and truth and goodness, which we all agree on. And when we cooperate, it's amazing what we can do. So I think the politics which we have in our society, a lot of it comes from our inability to learn how to cooperate as well as compete, to have this balance between the two. It's good in your marriage that you have your own career, your personal goals, but that should always be balanced with learning how to cooperate and having something which is bigger than me. And what's bigger than me is called us.
Ajahn Brahm, everything you said makes sense.
Yep, thank
you. It's very idealistic.
Now here we come. Go on.
But in the real world...
Ah, come on.
That you don't live in, we do. We are told that we have to look after ourselves. Like, you look after yourself because no one's here to look after you, whether you're in a company and even as you're growing up, if you've got lots of siblings. So... I think with that advice, then you tend to have to look after your own interest.
Looking after your own interests. But I always look after other people's interests most of the time. And because I've been serving Singapore, the Buddhist Fellowship and Buddhist Lodge for so long, it's amazing how many people look after me. I just was given some sweets. I had to tell the person I made a big mistake. When they gave me some sweets, I say, oh, those are the sweets I like. I thought, oh, why did I say that? Because if they tell somebody else, I'm going to have so many sweets, they're going to kill me with diabetes. But why is that? Why do people like being kind to a monk? It's a lot of time because of selflessness, because you're concerned about other people. Other people want to look after you.
But as a monk, you're no threat to us.
Aha, good. So why don't you be no threat to your husband? No threat to your wife. No threat. It is because our personal interests are challenged sometimes. And they're threatened. And because a lot of times we're looking at this wrong place. Again, going back to the politics in my real world between the different Buddhist groups which you see very clearly here in Singapore and other places in the world, that now, is there politics between the Mahayana, the Theravada, Hinayana, Vajrayana, Zen, all these other groups? And I said, look, listen, we've got so much in common. Why don't we just not look at each other, but look again what's between us? Because the two big mistakes in Buddhism is to think that Buddhism is sacrificing yourself for the sake of other beings. That's the Mahayana goal. I'm going to put off my own enlightenment, my own happiness, and I'm going to serve all other beings. May all other beings be happy and well. That is wrong. The Theravada so-called ideal, forget about other people, I'm going to look after myself and get enlightened. That is also wrong. Selfless compassion is wrong. Selfishness is wrong. And I'll tell you why. Selfless compassion is when we just look at the other person and we give to them. And many times in a family, or in an office, especially in the family, sometimes, especially the wives, the women, will like sacrifice themselves for the husband, for the kids, for the family, for everything. That doesn't work, as many of you are finding out. Now, what's the alternative? Is the alternative the so-called Hinayana way, just thinking about your own concerns, looking after yourself? That too is wrong. There's a middle way between Hinayana and Mahayana, and this is the best yana of all. I've coined it the Hahayana. And that's it. You're laughing. So I'm a follower of the Hahayana. Now, what I really mean there is the third option between sacrificing yourself for others and being selfish is actually to focusing on the relationship you have, what's between me and the other. Now this is such an important point in life. It's also an important point in meditation. It's not thinking about yourself in a marriage. It's not thinking about the others in a marriage. It's thinking of what lies between us, because that is where marriage exists. Marriage is not the husband, not the wife, not the children. It's what unites all of those together. What's between them. And I think if we look there, it's not me, it's not them. It's this us business. It's this we. And so as in the real world, okay, you might think you just live in a monastery and everything gets given to you and you're very happy, you don't have to worry about the rest of the world. That is not true. I am completely dependent upon you guys. If you didn't feed me and money, if you didn't take me back, I'd have to walk. I've got no money, I can't afford a bus or a taxi. I am completely dependent upon you. You know something, you're completely dependent upon me as well. It's all about us. This is like the synergy which we have in any community. One of the problems about politics is not seeing the big picture. And the big picture is always about us. Recently, I gave this simile of the forest in our monasteries. When I first moved to Australia 22 years ago, it was in a eucalypt forest, a special type of hardwood called jarrah. And because of the problems with environment, there's a disease, a fungus, which is attacking those trees called dieback. And so many trees had already died. When I first moved to this forest, I wanted to cut down all those dead trees, because they were ugly, they were like skeletons. I was stopped by someone who said, "Do you realize what you're doing? In those dead trees, these holes which form the habitat for possums, for potoroos, these little marsupials in that area, this is where the birds make their nests. These dead trees are part of the forest, they're part of the ecosystem. If you cut those down, you'll be damaging the balance of the forest." When I heard that and understood that, I realized my mistake. And not just a mistake with those dead trees, the trees which were diseased, old, ugly, the ones which were laying dead on the forest floor. I realized that every one of those was an important part of the forest. I understood that what I didn't like was important to the balance of that forest. It was necessary, it was essential to the life and health of the place where I lived. And from that, I made the extension to say, in any office, relationship, country, everybody has a place, has a value. Those dead trees, those ugly trees, those sick trees, our world would not be the same without them. We need the old people, we need the sick people, we even need the criminals in our society. This is a radical thing to say. They are part of the ecosystem called life. In the same way, in your family's situation, all of those irritating little things which sometimes are a source for the politicking in a society, that's important for your growth. Adds a texture to your family life. Because without those arguments which you have with your loved ones, there would not be the opportunity to say sorry and ask forgiveness. It's one of the things which I learned from my parents. They did have arguments. Sometimes they turned around and they wouldn't speak to each other, you know, for a few hours. But the wonderful thing about, I remember with my mother and father, it only lasted for a couple of hours, they would make up. They make sure they made up in front of myself and my brother. And we saw them sort of say sorry to each other, to kiss and hug. And because I saw that, I learned two important things. That arguments are part of life. But I also found that there's a way to end those arguments. And I saw that in front of me by just like a hug and a kiss and saying, it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. You're my husband, you're my wife. That's important. Let's make up. I saw that's the end of the politicking. When we see there's something more important than our differences. There's something more important about what tradition you are from, or even what religion you are, what race you are, what company you are working for. There's something more important than that. It's great to have those arguments that keeps us on our toes. It's great to have competition with Malaysia here in Singapore, with Indonesia, but there comes a time when we also cooperate and have this wonderful friendship. I think that is what I mean by the forest simile. All these sins which sometimes we try and get rid of with our so-called politicking, that's part of life. So if you have someone in your office who's really giving you a hard time, who's always on your back, always trying to get your job, next time you go and see them, say, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being so irritating, because you're teaching me patience. Thank you so much for being so competitive, because you're making me raise my game. Thank you so much, you know, for being just this awful, rotten person, because you help me see the awful and rottenness in myself as well. So you can actually appreciate some of the things you have to deal with in life, and that is the real world. So in my monastery, when there's somebody like that in our monasteries, always creating problems, I say, we give them a special name. We call them Ajahn.
That's your name.
Yeah, but we know what Ajahn means? It means teacher. So whoever's really irritating, who really gets up your nose and gives you a very, very hard time, call them Ajahn. And give them respect. Because they're teaching a very important lesson in life. Go on.
Ajahn.
Yes, Ajahn Andy.
You said that between a husband and wife is there's something in between them, and that's what we usually call love. But the kind of love that we seem to practice is very conditional. Yes. There's a transaction involved, right? And it's also a situation that it's the hardest person to forgive when they have hurt you.
Correct. So the hardest person to forgive, the one you're most critical of, is the one which is closest to you. Have you ever noticed that, say, that people would like to create harmony in the world? The Anglicans are working very, very hard to get some harmony with the Catholics. At the same time, the Anglicans are having huge rifts amongst their own sects. You may notice maybe the Theravada might like to sort of make some more friendship with the other Buddhist groups, but amongst themselves, they never get on. You can understand that when it's somebody very close to us, that's where we're the most critical. In your profession, whatever your profession is, you may be very tolerant of other professions, but within your profession, people have got slightly different views than you, really irritate you. It's what's really close to us. What's very, very close is always where we get the most friction. If they're far apart, we don't really rub up against each other too much. When they're very, very close, they're challenging what we call our attachments and the ways of looking at things. So it's true that sometimes that your partner in life, they're the ones you always argue with. But you know one of the reasons why? Because they're so important to you. If they weren't so important to you, there wouldn't be any point arguing with them. They're very, very important to you. You made a commitment to them because they're so important to you. This is why you invest all this energy in those arguments. Because you think it's really worthwhile. The point is that sometimes we don't know how to argue. If you can have an argument with your partner, please, please, please choose the right time and place to make it really effective. Timing is the essence in life. And the timing should be as follows. If you have an issue you wish to talk about with your partner, do not talk about it when they just come home from work having just fought through the traffic. If you really have an issue, take them out to dinner. If you're a girl, dress up. If you're a bloke, you know, you put a suit on. And take her out to the best restaurant, what you think she likes. Have as many courses as you possibly can have. It's called softening them up. And when you get to the final course, you find that, you know, your husband, your wife, whatever it is, they're just so soft, so mellow. You can talk about anything with them. And they'll listen. It's all in preparation. That's why in politics, when we have visitors from overseas, what do? They soften them up, first of all. Take them out to see this and see that, get them a nice dinner. When they're nice and soft, then they hit them with whatever they need to hit them with. Because it's just psychology. When, you know, you make that person feel that you're not attacking them, you're not their enemy, but, you know, you have friendship. You've got to establish that friendship and rapport, first of all, before you can talk about something. So a lot of times, even if there's any problems in a monastery, just put it aside, first of all, and get friendship happening, first of all. When is friendship, when is compassion, when is this mutual respect, you find you can talk about anything. Without that mutual respect, no one listens. All the conflicts in the world occur from a lack of mutual respect and concern. If Mr. Bush could show some concern, real concern, for, you know, the Islamic world, and the Islamic world can respect Mr. Bush, with that respect there, there's possibility for movement and for finding a solution. Not to my problem, not to your problem, but to our problem. It's always an our problem. We don't live in isolation anymore. That's the clearest thing in our modern world. What happens in Iraq affects Singapore, economy-wise, let alone seeing all the images on the TV screen. Even what happens in Bolivia affects Australia. We are just one little planet. We have to learn how to get on. It is our problem. Whatever happens anywhere on this globe. So, we cannot just ignore this. We have this mutual respect for all beings, this great compassion in Buddhism and in all religions. All beings deserve to be part of the forest. So let's listen to each other, respect each other, and actually then for that respect, for that friendship, then there's dialogue, then there's listening. But the friendship has to be established first. In a monastery, if there's a couple of months having a hard time, you soften them up, first of all. You know, you find out what they like and get someone to bring that dish to them that day. So they're really happy. All my monks, because I tell all these stories, and all my monks listen to these, they know if they want to ask any special privilege from me, they look what's given that day for the meal, and if they know it's something I like, I'm going to be in a good mood, they can ask anything, I'll say yeah. It's just like any other relationship. Look at your husband, look at your wife. You've been living with them for so long, you should be able to tell when they're in a good mood. When they're in a good mood, you can ask for anything. So soften them up, first of all. Same as your boss. Soften them up, and then ask for a raise.
Before I ask the next question, can we invite all the people who are standing to come up and fill up the space in the middle,
and
also
here, yeah,
come up in the front, because you might be blocking some people in the back, and also it's going to be a long night if you're standing up.
Okay.
Ajahn Brahm, when you're living with someone or seeing someone every day, their faults are very obvious, right? To the point that actually you see a lot more faults in the people that you're with than you see the good side of them after a while. So, I mean, how do you overcome that? Because it's so natural for the mind to keep seeing the faults of people.
Ah, again, this is a problem, seeing the faults within people. This is the problem of the competitive attitude. When we're competing, we're trying to be better, it's called ego, trying to be the best. Instead of actually trying to up our game, we try and pull other people down. That's actually competition. It's called mudslinging in politics. When instead of actually praising ourselves, we actually put down the opposition. And that happens in marriage. That can happen in religion. We never actually praise Buddhism. We just, that other mob down the road there, you know, with the cross, they're terrible, they're awful. We put them down. Now that is wrong. We should never do that. Instead of actually putting down anybody, actually let's up our game. Let's praise rather than find fault. This is our nature. We've been conditioned to be fault finders, so we have to condition ourselves to be more respectful. For the many years, because I am an abbot, I have to manage my monastery. It's almost like I'm married to my monastery. So every time I go to that monastery, I'd see all the things which needed to be done, all the things which were wrong, the things which needed to be fixed. It was like you see your wife, your husband, all the things which are wrong with them. When I realized I was doing that, it's a natural thing if you're a manager, if you're trying to get some advancement in your marriage, in your office, in your country or in your monastery. I realized that was not a good thing to do, especially when people would come and say, you've got a wonderful monastery, it's so beautiful. I said, what? Can't you see all the mistakes? It's the same way that some people say, you've got a wonderful husband, he's such a nice guy. What? Are you blind? But what I did, I said, I want to see my monastery the way that visitors see it. So see if you can see your wife, not as you see her, as her friends see her. To see your husband as his colleagues see him, not as you see him. And so to do that, I made this resolution that every Monday morning, because the weekend was really, really busy, I used to have a free morning on Monday, I'd say, I'm going to walk around my monastery with the eyes of a visitor. I'm not the abbot anymore. I don't own this monastery. I'm thinking I'm not even living here. I'm going to see it as a visitor sees it. Not an owner, but just someone who's there for the time being. And I started seeing all this amazing beauty in the monastery, just how wonderful it looked. Instead of seeing what was needing to be fixed, I saw all that had already been fixed. I saw all the hard work which had gone into that monastery over those 21, 22 years. When I saw all the beauty, the sacrifice, the hard work, finances, wow, that was really an impressive monastery. I started to see it as a visitor could see it. If you look at your partner in life, all of their struggle since they were a small kid, how hard they've worked through school, the challenges they've had in life, just getting by, growing up, meeting you in the first place, relationships are not difficult to make, let alone keep. The amount of work that person has done, how hard they've tried. Wow, you see that and you can respect your husband in a way you've never respected them before. You see something in your wife, just how hard she's tried. Not perfect, but she's done a damn good job in a way she's really tried to survive in this life, to do well at school, to get a job, trying hard for her family, for her kids, for you as well. When you see that, wow, you just want to give her a big hug. Say thank you. So you're seeing my monastery as a visitor sees it. See as your partner. Not as you see her, but as someone else would see her. It just opens your eyes. When we're so close to something, we can't see it properly. It's called the problem. This is a simile I haven't given here for many years now. How big is my hand? You know how big my hand is? It's so big now I can't see any of you. All I can see is my hand at the moment. Is it my hand's fault? Or is it because I'm too close to it? If I put my hand where it belongs, which is at the end of my arm, sure, I can see my hand. I'm not in denial about the existence of my hand. But I can also see every one of you in this room. Now, this is one of the times we have problems. We see a fault in our partner or a fault in life. It's not the fault's problem. It's just sometimes we put it in the wrong place. It's right up here. And that's all we can see, the fault. And we can see nothing else in our partner. We can see nothing else in our life. Why is it that many of our young people commit suicide? All they can see is what's wrong. It's true that things are wrong. But you have to get what's wrong and put it out here somewhere, please. So you can say, yeah, that is wrong. You have failed to get into university. Now you have lost your job. Now you have got a broken heart. But the broken heart is here. There's lots more in the world other than your broken heart. If it's broken heart's right up here, you want to kill yourself. Because that's all you can see. So a lot of times, problem solving is just getting perspective. The arguments with your husband is just moving backwards to see him, to see her if it's with a wife. As other people see them. Getting perspective. It's not so close to you anymore. It's out here somewhere. If you can do that, it's amazing what you can do just with the whole of life.
Ajahn Brahm, if you had a wife, which we know you don't, and you see her every day, isn't it hard after a while to really just, ignore the faults? I mean, what is some practical recommendations, like do you take holidays apart from each other?
The practical recommendations are you come to the Buddhist lodge to hear talks like this. Because no, like, those faults, they started out as charming. It's so charming the way you pick your nose, my darling. Whatever it is. It's amazing because the faults, they're actually what makes life beautiful. Because of Perth in Western Australia, we have an ocean to the westward of our city there. So we have these amazing sunsets in the evening over the Indian Ocean. We only have those beautiful sunsets when there's a few clouds on the horizon. Some faults, some defects in the clarity of the sky, because only those clouds will spread the colours, the beautiful crimsons and orange along the horizon, give these amazing sunsets. Without those faults, there will be no beauty. There's no beauty in perfection. There's no life just in perfection either. Life, is this balance, this yin and yang between perfection and imperfection, between the happiness and the suffering, between the arguments and the love. That is life. It's not the love which is between us, because you know that sometimes that's not there at all. What's in between us is something else. I'd say even something greater than us, or greater than life, or greater than love. And that's truth. Because truth sometimes metamorphoses into this beautiful love and sometimes this argument. Both are part of life, of light. Greater than love, greater than arguments, called life, truth. So if you can actually value that, the arguments are important. So don't think that something has gone wrong in our relationship. That is part of your relationship. It's part of monastic life, having monks who sometimes don't get on with each other. But you guys are going to live together. It's a wonderful thing in the monastic tradition that if you ordain together, you will sit next to each other for the rest of your life. Because we always sit according to the hierarchy of how long we've been ordained. So it's great to ordain two people who don't get on together right next to each other. And sure enough, they do learn to get on together. This is nature. When you have to, you will. So, if you're having an argument with your husband, the best thing to do is to, I'll get a room, I'll lock you in there for 3 months. Together. So you really can't get away from each other. I think getting time out, I think that might be something a bit too easy. Go closer together. Don't go apart. If you have an argument, don't run away. Run towards the problem. Don't run away from it.
Whether in family or at work, you have jealousies, right? Whether it's siblings or relatives or whoever. Or at work would be jealousy of your colleague getting promoted or getting more bonus or whatever that could be. What is the Buddhist approach to dealing with jealousy?
Well, actually, the Buddha mentioned this, and he gave this beautiful quality called mudita, which is the complete opposite of jealousy. Jealousy always comes from competing. Mudita, which is like sympathetic joy. When you rejoice at somebody else's success, and you have that quite naturally. If you see someone who's just won the lottery on the TV, don't you feel happy for them? Do you ever think, why did they win the lottery and not me? It's unfair. When you actually go to a marriage and you see this young couple, they're in love, they're daft and stupid about each other. Don't you feel just wonderful about that? Even though it's not you? It's a natural quality in a human being which can delight in the happiness of others. And that is encouraged in Buddhism. To actually to rejoice in other people's success. So if somebody else actually gets that promotion, wow, well done. You really deserve that. Thank you so much, you know, for inspiring me with what you've done. All it needs is to be encouraged in our world, to rejoice in other people's success. It actually stops our ego, and it means that we are successful now, that we rejoice together. So when one person is successful, it's actually not one person anymore. It's the same if somebody in Singapore wins a gold medal in the Olympics. The whole of Singapore is happy, aren't they? We all rejoice if Singapore wins the Tiger Cup, the last time I was here.
Oh, that's right, soccer. Yes. Soccer, yes.
Yeah. It was in the newspapers last time I was here. Everyone rejoices.
So that's because we don't know them. But, you know... But in an office, you know your colleague, and he or she didn't work as hard as you, and probably stepped up to the boss, and because of that, he got promoted, not because he was more hardworking. That makes you feel really lousy.
There you are now. I think if you get promoted, you have to work harder. So it's great. Yeah, they've got it. So, isn't it? So, you know, if you wanted it, you've got it. You're stuck with it.
But even in families, I mean, you know, children feel this favoritism, right? Oh, my mom loves my brother more than me.
Yeah.
Maybe because I'm a girl. I mean, you know, how do you get over that? Because you feel it's not fair. It's like, oh, I am born a woman this life, but I never asked for it.
Didn't you?
I was just asking for someone else.
Okay. And that's... Sometimes, again, that jealousy is always to do with me. And it's better for the whole family. If somebody else, you know, gets love from the mother, it's wonderful. You know, that I can actually stand back and see this beautiful relationship with, like, a son and his mother. Oh, it's wonderful to actually to see that. I get inspired. So you never think about yourself. You think about the family, what's good for the family. So I think a lot of times that jealousy is, again, looking at the wrong place. So looking at me, 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 me. We are getting the self-generation. Now when psychology always says to look after your own interests, make your own goals, go for your own goals, compete, work for yourself, do it your way, my way. That independence may be a balance for when we are too part of a bigger group. We're not focusing too much on our own needs. But it can go too far, lead to the jealousy, lead to me, 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 what I need, and stop this balance of an us-ness. It can also go the other way, being too self-sacrificing, too self-effacing, not standing up for yourself, just thinking about the others. It always has to go to us. What's actually beneficial for the whole family, for us? So if a mother is giving too much attention, say, to one of the siblings, it's not good for the whole family. So it's not a personal thing, it's an our thing.
Yeah, but you can't change mother, right?
Sure you can.
All right.
Or you can't change the person, but you can brainwash her, you can change her, when you know how to work with mothers. My mother said that I must have been a Buddhist in many previous lives, because you used to say I could twist around my little finger. Because, you know, children do manipulate their parents. Of course, they didn't know how to get their own way from their parents, the right way to ask things. And so this is also the right way, actually, not to manipulate, but to get what's best for us.
Can you teach us a little bit more?
Yeah. Okay. First of all, to realize that because we are a family, because we are all going together, we have to work together, that is paramount, the togetherness. Because look, if you think you can live alone, how many people are looking for a partner in life? And living alone, sometimes people get all sorts of psychological problems. Health problems, suicidal problems, other problems. Sometimes if you don't have a partner, at least you've got your friends, your friend network, which is, you know, also important. As a monk, I've got my monk network. So they're my family. So, you know, you're emotionally satisfied just by, you know, serving you guys, my fellow monks, looking after them. Those last two monks who came here, Venerable Brahmadi and Kemavaro, I call them my babies, because I ordained them as monks, and so now they're coming up and they're becoming adult monks now, serving. And just like any mother, like, I feel I'm their mother. And now they're doing all these wonderful things. I feel so proud of them. So I get a lot of emotional happiness from these. But we don't have any jealousy. If those two monks do so well in Singapore, that after a while people say, who's coming next week? Ajahn Brahmad, I've heard of his jokes, I'm not coming to him. Brahmadi, yeah, we'll come to his talk. If they do much better than me, and they become the star teachers, I'll be so happy. I can just stay and have a nice time resting and not do anything. So no jealousy. It's actually sympathetic joy. I feel so happy that people make it in the world and they do wonderful things.
Ajahn, what do you do in your monastery then if you had two monks who have problems getting along with each other because they just can't stand the sight of each other?
If I have two monks who can't stand the sight of each other, I try and arrange to give them jobs. They have to work with each other every day. So no, there's no escape. They have to work it out. But one of the great things is that human beings are so resourceful. If they have to, they will. And this is a great thing with human beings. If they have to work together, they do work together. And this is one of the stories in my little book. It's a great story about one of the early disciples, a Canadian girl who was living in Perth and married to an engineer. They were visiting from Toronto on a contract for 2 years in mining. When the contract had finished, they had to go back to Canada. Instead of buying airline tickets, they sold their house and they bought a boat, a little yacht. Their idea was, instead of flying to Toronto, they would sail. They were young, without kids, a trip of a lifetime. And when they got to Vancouver, BC, in Canada, they'd sell their yacht, they'd have their money for their next house. It was a great idea. And also, and a great adventure for young people. They needed some help, so they teamed up with another couple who were also going to Canada. So there was two couples, two husbands, two wives. When she got to Toronto, she wrote to me, and one of the stories she told on the voyage I've used in my book, and I've used in many stories about politics. Because what happened here in the middle of the void, somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, hundreds of miles from land, there was trouble in the engine room. Because the engine wouldn't work. There was no wind, so the boat was stuck. The two ladies were on deck, because they didn't know anything about engines, reading magazines. The two men were in this small engine compartment, which was very cramped, very hot, and if ever you try to fix up an engine, sometimes it's so frustrating. Sometimes even little things like getting a nut loosened from its bolt, sometimes it's just so hard it just doesn't want to get loosened. Sometimes when it is loosened, the thing falls in the most greasiest recess so you can't get it out again. And you put it together again, it just still doesn't work. Fixing up engines could be so irritating and frustrating. And this was one of those occasions. They were in there for a few hours, they couldn't get the problem fixed, and because of the heat and the irritation, they started to take the frustrations out on each other. Just like in a marriage. First of all, it was just like snide remarks, little put-downs. And that soon led to an argument. The argument soon raised in its intensity until they were shouting at each other. And then it got so furious they were hurling really unfair insults at each other, cursing each other. And at that point, one of the men threw down their wrench and said, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." And this apparently was a true story. That man was so mad with rage, he went to his cabin, washed, changed, packed his bags, and appeared on deck with his bags in his best suit. And it was only the laughter of the two girls that he realized there was ocean all around him as far as he could see. There was nowhere to go. And at that, this man went red in the face and did what the only thing he could do was go back to his cabin, change back into his work clothes, go back into the engine compartment and help out. They finished the voyage the best of friends. That's how conflicts are solved. It would be great if we could put Mr. Sharon and Mr. Abbas in a room together. Don't let them out until they come to a compromise.
From the sounds of the Ajahn Brahm, it seems like sometimes having choices is not the best thing when it comes to dealing with conflicts.
Sometimes the choices, we always take the easiest choice rather than the long-term best choice. Choices can be very confusing sometimes. And a lot of times when we take a choice, we take it out of fear. So this is why in life you have to be courageous. So this is why I said instead of running away from the problem, you run towards the problem. You face it with courage. And so this is important. This is my marriage, my family, my work, my country, my planet is important. So let's face these challenges which we have. Face them square on. I remember one of Ajahn Chah's disciples, who I got to know later on, was an ex-Prime Minister of Thailand. It was Dr. Sanya Thammasat. I think he's passed away a few years ago. I lost touch with him, but I think his son is now the Minister for Religious Affairs in Thailand, I believe. But anyway, that he used to come and visit Ajahn Chah very regularly. I remember him saying to me, he was Prime Minister for a short while, he said that there's never any problem in government I cannot solve. When I go and see my opponent, my enemy, just the two of us, and I put my hand on his knee, which is an expression of friendship, we talk about it. When I heard that from him as a young monk, I was very impressed, because this was someone who lived in the real world as a prime minister of a modern country. And he said he could solve those problems through friendship, which is that mutual respect, that opening up to say, it's not your problem, my friend, It's not my problem, it's our problem. We're stuck together, whether it's in the boat of our little family or the boat of our country. Singapore's not that big. And our planet's not that big either. Basically, where can we go to? This, the ocean of space surrounding us. We have to learn how to live together. These bombs are getting bigger and more violent. Can we afford to have some crazy maniac with a nuclear bomb exploding it somewhere? If we don't solve our problems together, what future is there for life on this planet? What future is there for you if you can't live with this person you've already got? Sometimes you think if you trade them in you can get somebody better. But one thing I will tell you, those people who've been married many times, all husbands are the same, basically. All wives are the same. You may have a slightly different hairstyle, slightly different face, but they're basically the same. So the one you're with is as good as you're going to get. So why don't you make the best of that? And you can make the best of it because it's not the husband, it's not the wife, it's not who they are which is the problem. It's how we relate to them. What's in between us? That's the problem.
But Ajahn Brahm, what if it's someone who is dishonest, who lacks integrity, who's full of himself? I mean, how do you put up with someone like that? I mean,
okay.
How do you respect someone
you
like
got,
that?
So this evil person, they're dishonest, that they are selfish. So instead of actually looking at it's their problem, instead of seeing it's my problem, why not say it's our problem? So it's not the
but
fact
you can
that
get rid of them.
Sorry? Where can they? They're like just, if you get rid of them, you get somebody worse coming next. This is actually the problem about putting people in prisons. Thinking that somehow or other we can put them away somewhere, out of sight, out of mind, and thinking that therefore we're solving the problem. And I think everyone knows when a person goes to a prison, they're going to come out again sooner or later. If they die in prison, they get reborn again as Buddhists. They're going to come back. So unless we actually solve the problem, it's not just putting them away or even executing them. There's a problem there. And it's not their problem. It's our problem. We have to do something about this. So when there is the recognition of where the problem lies, then somebody's lying. Someone is being selfish. When it's my problem, as well, it's not my problem, it's our problem, then I have a job to do something about that. Why do you think I'm in Singapore now? I live in Perth. What's Singapore got to do with me? No, no, it's Australia's problem. It's Singapore's problem. Singapore's problem is Australia's problem. It is our problem. That's why I'm a Buddhist monk. Not just to solve my problems, not just to get enlightened by myself, to realize there's a whole commitment here to do something about the problems of life. Because if someone is hurt over in, say, Africa, that hurts me. Maybe I can close my eyes for a few moments. If I see some kid having his hand chopped off by, you know, these militia gangs, I can't just say that's nothing to do with me. I've got a responsibility. That hurts me. I've got a responsibility. I've got to do something. It's not their problem. Even though I'll probably never go to that country, I care. As each one of you do care. Because of that, that compassion for all sentient beings, which a Buddha recognized, that's not something we say, may all sentient beings be happy and well, thinking that we're making compassion. What we're doing when we say, may all sentient beings be happy and well, is affirming a compassion which already exists in us. It's there already. We're making it clear to ourselves. So because of that, we have to help. So someone who's lying all the time, I want to find out why. Find out some mechanisms or some way of healing that problem. So I go out and teach. I write books. I write about forgiveness. The fact that you can forgive anything. Because in that forgiveness, that acknowledgement, the forgiving and the learning from what we've done is the growth. So I say to anyone who's lied to me, you're forgiven. Straight away. It doesn't matter. You can still be my friend even though you've lied to me. There's something happens there with a person. When you're actually so soft and trusting to somebody else, they don't think they want to lie to you anymore. This is what I found with visiting prisons. These were some tough monsters in these jails. But when I actually respected them, it's amazing the change which happened. Sometimes people would ask, how could you look at a rapist like that? We have something in Buddhism we call Buddha nature. Every being has Buddha nature. What does that mean? It means every being has this core of purity, of goodness, of compassion inside of them. If you can see that in another being and focus on that, then they deserve forgiveness. Because you're forgiving a future Buddha. All one needs to do is not focus on the faults and mistakes. Focus on their potential, their Buddha nature inside. Because the first step in forgiveness, and it's a crucial step, before you forgive somebody, you have to see something in them which is worthy of forgiving, which actually qualifies them for your forgiveness. If you've had an argument with your husband or with your wife, you can't see anything good in them. There's no way you can actually have any reconciliation there. You've got to actually go back and just look for the goodness in your husband, their Buddha nature. It doesn't matter if they're a Christian or a Muslim. No, Buddha nature is just this idea, this potential for goodness and purity. If you see that in the other person, you can see something to respect. And then you can forgive.